Welcome to Navigating Consciousness. I'm Rupert Sheldrake, and this is a podcast of my talks and conversations. If you enjoy listening, please subscribe and leave a review in your favorite podcatcher. It really helps.
The fact is, however one tries to get out of it, they do seem to be dealing with a new conception, a pulling rather than a pushing, something that's more Aristotelian than mechanistic, something that involves the pulling from in front. And on the cosmological reason level, we get to what Terence and I were discussing this morning, the idea of an attractor for the entire cosmic evolutionary process.
Well, I have to admit that when I heard this morning from both of you, my jaw dropped. I was astonished at this interpretation, and and I can't say it's wrong, but I can say that it's different. I'm sure it's different from the way that any mathematician has thought about attractors in dynamical systems before. I think it's an arbitrary interpretation. I mean, here we have the track, and here we have the train going down the track. Now we know that the train is going to keep on going down the track, and it's going to get to the next station in 7 minutes. Is the station pulling the train? So the dynamical system, like what we think of the dynamical system, is the rule, which is the track. That when the train is a certain place, it's on the track. Where is it going to go next? It's going down the track. The rule is the train will go down the track. Some trains are going to jump track, but basically the rule is the track where the train now is. And as a matter of fact, it leads on to where the train is going to be next. And then the rule is applied again. I mean, we have a game that we're playing here according to rule, if you consent to play. And that is, the rules of the game are that when you are in this spot, you go this way. When you are in this spot, you go this way. And these rules, the rules of the game, the running rules, comprise the agreement. That's the dynamical system. Now, there's some mathematics somewhere. Maybe there isn't even, but we imagine that then you just turn the crank on the axiomatic system, and it says eventually you'll get to a destination, the station, which might not be a point. It might be a circular track, or it might be a tangled up heap of track, which is a chaotic attractor. That doesn't mean that the attractor is pulling the train. So to think of the attractor as pulling the train, I think, is suggested by the word attractor, which never, ever, when we thought of this word in the early 1960s, did we ever think that it would be interpreted in this way. But now I can see it's the obvious interpretation that anyone would make when they read this word.
Yes. And the same problem was confronted by Sir Isaac Newton. I mean, when he chose the word attraction for gravitational attraction, as Voltaire said in 1730, when he visited London, this was years after, 30, 40 years after Newton, 50 years after Newton developed these ideas, they were still not accepted in France. And Voltaire said the principal reason the French academicians scorned Newton's ideas was that he'd used the word attraction. Voltaire said if he'd used a different word, his ideas would have been more readily accepted. Because the word attraction, which for the French then, as it still does for us today, has connotations of sexual attraction and is steeped in sort of animistic and subjective associations, seemed to them perfectly absurd. The idea that the earth could be attracting a stone in a way that had anything to do with the way that an attractive woman could be attracting a man seemed to them absurdly animistic. And Newton was... Voltaire said if he'd chosen a different word, his theories would have been adopted 30 years earlier in France. Now, Voltaire may have been wrong, but the fact is that his ideas weren't accepted in France, and from the very beginning, the notion of gravitational attraction, because of these animistic associations, was a difficulty for people. But the fact is that Newton, by substituting gravitational attraction, managed to build a mechanistic cosmology that replaced an animistic cosmology by introducing animistic principles by subterfuge. In Aristotle's view of the world, stones fell because they were attracted to the earth. They were attracted to their proper place. They were going home. It was a kind of attractive process. Newtonian physics said, oh, no, no, it's completely wrong to think of nature working on attractions. Stones fall because of attraction. And then, if you say, well, wait a minute, isn't that rather a funny word to use? They said, oh, no, no, forget about any sort of animistic associations. This is a totally technical term. Now, so we've been through this particular thing before.
We have, yes.
And what's happened is that in the evolution of science since the mechanistic revolution, attraction has been reinvented again and again. And its inventors choose the name, and then their supporters then disavow that this is what they're saying, because the name has such an inherent appeal and plausibility. It seems to correspond to the way nature's going. They then remember that science isn't meant to be like that, and sort of pretend that actually it's just a coincidence. You could have called it something else. But Newtonian physics and the triumph of the mechanistic system, in my opinion, only works because what it was seeking to deny was introduced into it by a kind of subterfuge, and pretended that this was a mechanical principle, whereas it was something else. And I suspect that the same is true with your dynamical attractors myself. And you see, I think even if you take your example of the train, the station isn't pulling the train, but in a sense what's motivating the train is the purpose of the people getting to New York or Los Angeles or London. Unless human beings were purposive and had destinations they wanted to get to, unless railway companies had schedules and planned the way they ran the trains in accordance with what they thought supply and demand was, that train wouldn't be running. There's a sense in which the station is an attractor. If I want to go by train to London, I get on a train that's going to London because in a sense it's my purpose to go to London. And the idea that the train can be modelled as if there's a tractor, but actually it's just a dynamical system running along rails that happens to end up in London. If you observe enough trains on the London railway line, you see lots of them going to London, so you put in the model that London's an attractor, but it's got nothing to do with attraction. That's, in a sense, a subterfuge, because it has got a great deal to do with attraction. There are railway lines running nowhere in particular that very few people travel on. Railway companies close them down because they say there's no demand. So I think you see that there is this implication, and I think even in your chosen example it's really there.
Well, I think it's a good analogy with Newton's attraction. And there are, with his theory, or equally in general relativity, some unresolved, difficult problems about action at a distance in space. And I think that we have the same thing here, but it's a question of action at a distance in time. And there are two different times that I'm being confused, and I think the idea of two-dimensional time that a couple of people have already suggested could aid us here. The train goes down to the track and arrives at the station, and that's the attractor, but it's not actually pulling the train. So there is an action at the given instant before the train arrives at the station. The arrival at the station is still in the future. The problem with thinking of the station pulling the train is that the cause is then in the future. That's the problem with this teleological approach. However, your argument that the station pulls the train because the people want to go there applies to a different kind of time, and that's the time on the scale of the evolution of the train system. And people used to get off the train there, and there was no station. They asked the conductor for it to stop, and after many people did, and then they built the station there, and so on. So I think the more interesting thing, rather than a dynamical model with attractors and so on as the exerting the influence over the past to approach the future, the more interesting idea is to make a model for evolution itself, in which the train system, with its various distribution of stations, even the location of towns, the size of London as opposed to the size of Brighton and so on, all of this is evolving slowly in the course of another kind of time, a time in centuries. And there we have this pattern is coming forth on a trajectory in another space, which is also going to an attractor, which is the final configuration, the city plan, the location of cities, the network of train tracks, and so on. And the evolution of that is also going toward an attractor. But is it being pulled by the attractor? So I think it's not, because the people are exerting their will by getting on and off the train wherever they want. And that's the real cause, as it were. The determinant of evolution is the free will in the moment, is the collective action of the citizens in the present.
Well, just one more thing I should say before we ask Terence for his opinion. There's a sense in which we face this problem in our own psychology, there's a sense in which our own motivations... See, motivations in the ordinary psychological sense are not pushing from behind, but pulling from ahead. And in courts of law, seeking to establish the cause of what happened, you know, motivation is very important. Did so-and-so willfully murder so-and-so? And if so, what was their motive? The motive isn't what... if they did it in order to kill them, in order to inherit money that they would inherit through their will, there's a sense in which a future state or an imagined future state is what's pulling them. And there's a sense in which our own motivation, we have desires and goals, we have purposes and aims, even if just like coming to Esalen this weekend, all of us had the intention of getting here, and the intention preceded our coming here. And the sense in which the goal of being here at Esalen this weekend drew our behavior towards it, and that goal was in the future. So there's a we face the same problem when dealing with our own psychological motivations, which we know most about. We know more about our own motivations than about the functioning of the course of nature. And I would have thought exactly the same problems arose. And the concept of morphic attractors in morphic resonance theory and in Aristotle's notion of the soul, the concept of the entelechy, is trying to deal with this fact that somehow in the present, the system, the person, the developing animal, the developing plant, in the present, is subject to the influence of a potential future state that hasn't yet come into being. But that future state is what directs and guides and attracts the development of the present system. Now, is that future state existing in the present in some other dimension or direction of time, or is it actually out there in the future and pulling from tomorrow or the day after tomorrow through time? I mean, these may be just different ways of trying to imagine how this is working.
Now we've arrived at the imagination.
Exactly. Over to Terence.
I think Whitehead had a phrase called appetition for completion, which is, I take to be what this attractor notion is seeking to concretize. If we didn't use the word attractor, we would try to be true to the notion that the thing was being pushed from behind, the process, then we would have to use a word like the propeller or the motivator. And in these cases, I think intuitively, or perhaps it's just the habit of my own thinking, these seem to be inelegant terms. They seem to immediately raise questions of operational detail that attractor doesn't. We know how things are attracted to something. They simply move toward them. But if something is propelled towards something, if something is motivated towards something, then we have to visualize an engine strapped to it that is moving it toward an end state, which it somehow is able to magically find, where if you view the attractor as the bottom of an energy well, then anything put into the energy well will make its way to the attractor, because the attractor is the least energetic state. And so the whole system tends to move in that direction. The idea that the cause is in the future makes hash of the notion of causality. And so this is, I think, on the part of science, something that they are very concerned to eliminate, because the backwash from that assumption will make the practice of science much more difficult. Nevertheless, Ralph and his colleagues have been modeling for many years now plant growth, the dripping faucets, coupled oscillators like groups of cuckoo clocks hung on the wall and this sort of thing. The modeling task, ne plus ultra, is history. This is where you're no longer playing a little game to demonstrate something to a group of students or colleagues, but where you actually are saying our models, our methods are powerful enough that now we will take on the real world, not even the real world of biology, but the real world of the felt experience of being embedded in human institutions. Well, when you look at history, I think the whole reason history has bogged down in the 20th century is because of the absence of belief in an attractor. This is the hideous legacy of existentialism and all the philosophies constellated around it, that there is no attractor, there is no appetition for completion. Everything is referent to the past up through the present and no further. So that's what I think about the last part of the thing. What interested me more, and this appealed more to my own kinkiness, because it caused me to think something I had never thought before, even though on one level Rupert was taking liberties with my material. This notion about complexity and cooling, I saw, perhaps because I heard it from his lips rather than my own, I saw a dimension which I had never seen before, which is my tendency is always to carry any principle to the ultimate extrapolation. And if, in fact, the increase of complexity in the life of the universe is directly related to falling temperatures in the universe, then it seems to me it's reasonable to suppose that the most complex states in the projective history of the universe will occur at very low temperatures. Well, isn't it interesting then that phenomena like superconductivity and stuff like that has to do with low temperatures? And superconductivity is fascinating to cybernetic engineers because it's a way to preserve information from decay. You see, if you put information into a superconducting circuit operating around absolute zero, it will be impossible to disrupt that circuit without destroying it. And people like Erwin Schrödinger, as early as the mid-30s, suggested that since life seeks to stabilize itself against mutation, the obvious principle to be brought in to aid in that task would be something very much like superconductivity. Well, I don't want to belabor the point in my little space of time, but in fact, the way in which charge transfer and things like that occur in DNA suggests that nature may have incorporated this principle into its mechanics. What this says to us in the present that is particularly poignant, I think, is that our cultural phase transition that we are going through vis-a-vis machines may signify that we are not, as I have always thought, very close to the maximized state of novelty, but that we're somewhere out in the middle of that wave that goes from the beginning to the end, and that what the cultural transition that we are doing is about is we are downloading all novelty so far achieved into a much colder and stabler regime, the cold and stable regime of silicon crystals and arsenic doped chips and this sort of thing. And that, and this is, you know, a fairly appalling idea, because I think we all have a horror of being replaced by machines. But on the other hand, prokaryotes were replaced by eukaryotes, and there have been several of these replacement scenarios in the history of life. So I think it's interesting that that you make this point about cooling and complexity. It seems to me to imply that in my own theory, the zero point may in fact be the absolute zero point, and that what the time wave or the fractal of time really describes is the fluctuation of the career of heat over the life of the universe, and that in domains of high heat, information is degraded and novelty is lost, and there is a kind of recidivist tendency, and when temperatures fall, order reasserts itself and stabilizes.
Well, I think that the storage in low temperatures is interesting, because I think one of the things, when Ralph said this, mathematics is like language as a modeling system, I think there's a very big difference between spoken language and written language. When you get written language, the first ones we know about are written on rocks, the ultimate low-temperature crystalline storage system. The Ten Commandments, as given to Moses, were written on tablets of stone. I mean, this is this kind of permanent storage system. And you know, putting things in silicon crystals is a more sophisticated way, but this is essentially a low-temperature storage method. You couldn't do it, you couldn't write on water or in the wind. So I think that this language and the written language creates the illusion for us of an independent world. I think the realm, I myself think the notion of platonic forms and this ideal, this transcendent eternal world couldn't have arisen until written language had arisen, because written language produced the model, and by what I think of as a kind of idolatry, these man-made symbols and structures, languages and mathematics, when written down, can be imagined to endure forever in some kind of other realm, as if there's some kind of celestial rock or celestial stone or celestial crystal in which they endure forever. But the reality of language, as it's existed for a far longer period of its history, and as it exists right now here as we talk to each other, is in spoken language. And spoken language is a process that happens in time, and the memory involved in spoken language, which comes when stories are retold, like the bards and the transmission in oral cultures, there is no written record. So the spoken record, the story, organically develops as time goes on, and there's nobody around to say, well, look, you've got the story wrong, because in the book it's written like this. The thing organically evolves. And so I think a model of language is a kind of model of reality. An oral tradition has this constantly evolving and conserved, and yet conserved, model. But as soon as you've got a written one, as soon as you've got written records or written mathematical formulae, you get the impression, an imaginary realm of sort of eternal forms, by just sort of projecting the notion of things written down. Anyway, that was just what I wanted to say in response to what you said, and I think that's one way in which we get this, or we could easily get, I'm not saying for sure the mathematically Platonic or Pythagorean realm is an illusion, but it would be easy to see how such an illusion could be produced.
Well, I imagine, just to be contrary, that mathematics preceded not only writing, but mathematics probably preceded language as well. Certainly, mathematics preceded writing. And in mathematics, we have, for example, a circle, a line. I mean, these are, for Plato, the ideal ideals. Right, so do we need writing on stone to think of a line or a circle or a triangle as being eternal form? And the evolution of this kind of mathematics preceding writing was probably done by drawing in sand. And writing evolved by drawing in sand, and only later you had drawing on stone. So I think, I mean, it's just possible that the idea of eternal forms, laws, and so on emerged before writing on stone, and that writing on stone was just, as a matter of fact, a concretization of those. It just suggests a migration in evolution from the immaterial to the material, from the abstract to the concrete, and it's the opposite of what a lot of people think.
Your theories are the theory part of chaos. Reading your terminology here, isn't a model, how does it relate to, isn't a model for the chaos in society, in our world today, and what does it tell you about that? And
yeah, I used to answer when I went on the airplane and the person in the next seat would say, what do you do? And I say, oh, well, I'm a math professor. I do research in mathematics. And then they always say, that's my worst subject. And the conversation would end. So I soon learned to pretend that it was something else. Well, I write books. Oh, yeah? What kind of books? Well, textbooks. Well, that would, you know, end the conversation. Once, as a kind of accident, I said, well, I study chaos theory. And the person immediately said, now that's a subject I know a lot about. That was many years ago, but I rejected that. And so at that point, I would have answered to your question, no. I didn't think there was very much relationship between mathematical models with chaotic behavior on the one hand, and the chaos in life, what people are talking about when they say that's something I know a lot about, they're talking about a problem in their relationship or in the middle of the argument with their mate or something. So, but my attitude has changed over the years, and more I've been trying to make models in the social sciences in general, and now I have, for example, a project in psychoanalysis to model, working with a group of psychoanalysts, to model the therapeutic situation. And their idea was, I mean, in the experience of their practice of psychoanalysis, they had the feeling that the patient would present, that's a technical jargon, I gather, of that field, would present chaotically. That the presentation would become more chaotic, and that was to them a clue that the trigger was approaching for an episode or something. So they came to me saying, could you model this? Could we have data where we could sort of meter the extent of chaos, like my parameter GN in the ocean? And that was a few years ago, and so it's progressed, and now I'm working on, I call it aerodynamics, E-R-O, models for the love relationship, and for the synergy of in society, social synergy in a group of nations, for example, what does lead to war and what leads to cooperation? How do you resolve conflict and so on? So I do feel that it is, I won't say possible, it's conceivable in course of time, given its adequate evolution of the modeling art of this hermeneutical circle the gentleman has described so well in the context of the ships and the models for the ships, that we could reach a point where we had models that were decent in some sense to aid us in the understanding of complex social relationships. A group of people like two, three, a group this size, a group of nations, a world of nations, the evolution of society, and Terence's dream, a model for history itself. This is kind of, it's thinkable. It's not unthinkable. We're not at a point where we can meter the chaos in the room and say, they're about to break for dinner. Recently, a month or two or three ago, given a talk here to a group of social scientists about the possibilities of mathematical modeling, and their response was really angry and hostile. The very idea of a mathematical anthropology or a mathematical sociology, they thought was really offensive.
A different kind of investment in that part.
It's weird, right?
You would get different kind of different ones, maybe not.
It reminds me of when catastrophe theory had come out and people were looking at using it on politics, especially revolutionary politics, that there are certain political and social changes which occur peacefully in an incremental manner, but those same changes will occur catastrophically if, for example, the economy is in trouble. So they were attempting to use catastrophe theory to model politics. They weren't able to get enough data, I think, to make a practical model.
Actually, that's a good case, because it was very promising, is still very promising, but it suffered a kind of a sociological or historical accident, where a wave of popular hostility built up over catastrophe theory in a series of newspaper articles and within the mathematical community, and it killed it. It killed a very promising strategy of model building for the social sciences. Anyway, it was very limited. It was a temporary stage on the way to what we are doing now with these systems. And I don't know if it will save the world or anything, but I can tell you it's a lot of fun.
Ralph, in line with the question about sociology, do you still cling to the mathematical proof of the impossibility of monogamy?
I don't remember your asking that 2 years ago, Terrence. Nor ever before.
I remember making the mistake.
Not only I don't remember, but I say I proclaim to you all it's impossible I ever made such a statement, because, as I've just explained to Rupert, I don't believe in the resonance between the models and the actuality of ordinary life. I think that it evolves our understanding to play with models. Or, well, they do have a certain practical value, but I don't consider that the interesting part. So if I had a mathematical proof of the impossibility of monogamy in a certain model universe of model relationship in level 3, I might have spoken about that, and you made what Gregory Bateson called a category error and thought I was talking about human relationship, but you know, I'd never actually speak about human relationship.
But they should have told me after the year like that.
This whole notion about the role of modeling, I find very helpful for the discussion, especially where it's tied in with a feedback to between the abstracting and the concretized, blends them together so that your model, say, your model out. And any piece change with itself, and tied to this notion of the attractor. If you model an attractor, does your model have attractive properties? Does it begin to become a concrete or an attractive entity?
We'll have to ask Terrence about this, since he's been using this word extensively today, appetition, and I don't know exactly what it means. Terrence, are models attractive? I mean, are they habit-forming? Is modeling a habit?
I think so. I think if a model is a good model, it will begin to attract. It will begin to pull energy toward itself. It's almost like the idea of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And in a way, that's what I see the three of us and others mentionable as doing. We're trying to create a self-fulfilling prophecy where it's such a good idea that it will act as an attractor and the world will move.
Yes, a good dream for a future with a future.
Yes.
Well, maybe it's an appropriate time just to make mention of this area of mythology and ritual, that here we have a kind of model which has been thought to be crucial for the evolution of a society, and it could be that certain models are attractive in that realm, for example, the Trinity, or one God. I think that it's possible, I mean, there's an alternative possibility in that the models aren't attractive exactly, but you have springing up thousands of new societies around the planet every few years, and some of them will survive. They're like mutations in the social sphere, and some will survive for a while and others not, and some may have a really huge history, like 3,000, 5,000 years, or our civilization, and how old is this one? Starts with the Renaissance or in the time of Christ? Is, say, in the Renaissance, this particular model where this very complicated pantheon of gods and goddesses. I think it could be natural selection of societies that have adopted a certain model and made it a habit, whether attractive or not. And then the longevity is not because the model is attractive, but because it has a certain evolutionary advantage or advantage in whatever is the selection mechanism. Or it could be that certain models, like the Trinity, are intrinsically attractive, and that's why there are so many societies with Trinity as their model, which had a long lifetime.
Well, where does it make it over? You know, where does it, the model cross over when this Frankenstein's monster get, you know, citizenship papers or... How does the model stay not part of the real world? See what I'm saying? They're trying to get at here.
Yeah. But the model takes on a kind of social reality, doesn't it? In a religious system, like Islam, for example, the model of God, which Islam has, this strongly emphasized monotheism, actually takes on a social reality. It's reflected, if you have one God, then the earth is sacred, but then you have the idea there should be one sacred place on earth, so you have all pilgrimage to Mecca, all mosques pointing to Mecca, you have one God mirrored in this one central. So you have a model actually becoming a social reality. This is a common thing. But there's one, let me just conclude one further thought on this line. I think that the history of religions is one of the things that it tells us, is that all temples, images, diagrams, all the paraphernalia of religion, ritual forms, in some sense have a modeling function. Some of them may be symbols that participate with the reality they're describing. And one of the constant dynamics in the history of at least Western religions is the way in which the models are taken to be the reality by people. It's a recurrent danger of models, and in the Judeo-Christian tradition it's called idolatry. It's that the model of reality, the image of the God, is taken to be the God itself. And I myself think that one of the problems of the mechanistic worldview is that the mathematical models of classical physics were taken by many people to be the actual reality governing the world. So the idea was there was this mathematical mind governing. And this became the God of the materialist or the atheist, this kind of the mathematical models, the images of reality became the ultimate reality for them.
A possible interesting example of a religio-poetic myth becoming a horrible attraction. Between the 11th and the 13th century in Western Europe, there was a very important paradigm shift of place, namely the recognition of the importance of the feminine principle. And this affected life in every way. One of the ways to do it is to see the shift in the style of architecture, say, between the Romanesque construction that was used in the lower portions of the Abbey of Mont-Saint-Michel, and say the Cathedral of the Chartres. Now, Mont-Saint-Michel was built for the glorification of Saint Michael, who was the most powerful of all the angels, the one that threw Satan out of heaven. A very masculine thing. It's a masculine building. Very little decoration, thick walls, very little small windows, solidly built. A masculine style of architecture. If you go to Chartres, you see the apotheosis of the feminine style of architecture. This act, I think, is in the sense of what you're calling an attractor, because between the 11th and the 13th century, beginning around the beginning of the 12th century, hundreds of these Gothic cathedrals were built in Europe, all for the adoration of the Blessed Virgin. Hundreds of them, at an enormous expense, an enormous effort. I remember this was a poor time, and Europe put an enormous amount of their effort into doing this, and I can only see this as the attractive power of a myth created on. Is it?
Well, it must be something like that. It only did. And it must be something to do with the feminine aspect of creativity. You see, one of the things that Ralph and I were thinking about earlier today, we were having a conversation after lunch, that we find both masculine and feminine creative principles in mythology, and both masculine and feminine creative principles come in trinities quite frequently, the triple goddess, but then in the Christian world, the male trinity. And Ralph was saying, well, maybe there would be, since there seems to be this possibility of looking at it either way, there must have been somewhere in which the two threes formed a six, and the two creative trinities interlaced. And then I catch was that the Star of David is just such a diagram, two interpenetrating triangles.